supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Around for centuries, but in the midst of today's Holocaust, it seems almost unchecked. The Civil War we hear so much about today began in the 80s when the Arab government imposed fundamentalist Islamic law. The South rebelled and the ruling government reacted. So far, over 2 million people were killed and there have been 4 million refugees. African villages in the South are routinely raided and women and children are taken. By some estimates, over 250,000 people in the Sudan are living in slavery today, and that number grows every day. Human beings are bought and sold for $36. When Cherry Hill Samantha Gardner was 11 years old, she first heard about these atrocities and decided to do something about it. Through her work, she eventually made contact with Simon Deng. Now living and working in New York, Deng was born in the village of Tanga in southern Sudan and taken into slavery when he was 9 years old. Samantha Gardner and Simon Deng join me here in the studio. Welcome to the show, Samantha.
Thank you.
Simon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
And joining us on the telephone from Boston is Jesse Sage. He's a member of the board of directors of the American anti-slavery group called I Abolish. You can find them at iabolish.org. He's co-authored Enslaved, True Stories of Modern Day Slavery. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Jesse, these numbers, you know, they're numbers, but they're really breathtaking. Why is there not more outrage and activism?
Well, on the one hand, you could say that there is a good activism, and it's coming from the grassroots level by young leaders like Samantha. But the big question, I think, that you're asking is why haven't political leaders and international leaders done more? And on the one hand, it's a little bit of a mystery. There's not a good explanation because there's not really a debate anymore about whether slavery is a good thing or a bad thing. The moral argument has been won. Slavery is universally regarded as an evil. No one will publicly defend slavery or slave raids. And yet, prominent international leaders have failed to speak out in any major way on this.
Why?
Part of the problem is that the victims are not often given a platform to share their story and make their plight heard. And part of the problem is international geopolitics.
What do you mean?
Well, the countries that condone slavery tacitly, like Sudan, for instance, have a seat at the United Nations. And in fact, Sudan at various times has been a chair of the UN's Human Rights Commission. And the people who are enslaved, of course, do not have a seat at the UN and do not have a vote. And the result is that blocks of countries that don't want to have slavery talked about are discussed on the United Nations agenda prevent any discussion of this. And so the result is that you do not see the international community via the United Nations directing significant resources at holding governments accountable for their failure to stop slavery and, in certain cases, for their sponsorship of slavery.
Jesse, help us understand what slavery is. I know there's a lot of ways of looking at it, and we use the language of slavery so easily. I mean, you know, slave to fashion and slave to work. Where's the line? I also wonder about, you know, people working, you know, in third world countries for these big international firms that are barely making a subsistence wage.
We define slavery for our purposes with a very strict definition, which is forced work for no pay under the threat of violence. It doesn't mean that there are not other cases where there's exploitative labor. There are, of course, millions and millions of cases that do not fall under our very strict definition of slavery. That being said, even within the strict definition of slavery, as you mentioned, there are millions of people who are held in bondage today. In the case of the sweatshops that you mentioned, in most cases, it's not actually slavery. It may be abusive working conditions. However, there have been cases, including even in the U.S., where a sweatshop was actually a slave condition. An example I'm thinking of was in a suburb of Los Angeles, where there was a large home in a suburb that was had barbed wire around it. And when police finally raided the home, it turned out there were 70 people from Thailand who'd been smuggled in illegally and were forced to work under threat of violence sewing clothes. They were not paid, and they were held against their will. Most sweatshops don't rise to that level, or sink to that level, perhaps I should say. But you see different forms of slavery around the world. We, as I mentioned, use a very strict definition.
I just want to reintroduce you. The voice you just heard is Jesse Sage. He's a member of the board of directors of the American Anti-Slavery Group. You can find him at iabolish.org. He's co-authored Enslaved, True Stories of Modern-Day Slavery. And that's what we're talking about today, the human side of modern-day slavery, specifically in the Sudan. Soon we're going to be talking with Simon Deng, who grew up in southern Sudan, who was taken into slavery when he was 9 years old. And Cherry Hill's Samantha Gardner will be joining us. She got very involved in this modern-day slavery when she was just 11 or 12 years old. Well, you're listening. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
On The Next Humankind, we examine how the American civil rights movement strove not only for equality, but also to change the hearts of opponents through nonviolent protest. And a visit with Dr. Arun Gandhi, grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, who deeply influenced Martin Luther King. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for Humankind from PRI Public Radio International.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about modern-day slavery, actually the proliferation of modern-day slavery, the human side, the personal side. We'll be talking in a minute with Simon Deng, who grew up in southern Sudan in the village of Tanga. He was taken into slavery when he was 9 years old. We'll be speaking with Samantha Gardner, who got involved. She lives in Cherry Hill. And she got involved when she heard about these atrocities and is very active dealing with modern-day slavery. And I'm also joined by Jesse Sage on the telephone. He's a member of the board of directors of the American anti-slavery group, I Abolish. Jesse, let me just ask you to focus on Sudan for a minute. Seems like Sudan is probably one of the worst offenders in the world today when it comes to slavery. Tell us what's been happening in that country.
Well, the first thing when discussing slavery in Sudan, it's important to provide a historical context, which is Sudan is an Arabic word for land of the blacks. And for centuries, the indigenous black African tribes of Sudan have faced slave raids from Arab and Ottoman raiders coming from the north. This really, the tradition of slavery goes back centuries and centuries, even before the transatlantic slave trade. Blacks were being taken from Sudan to Arabia to serve as slaves. And this traditional slavery was largely stamped out by the British during the colonial rule at the beginning of the 20th century. What happened, though, towards the end of the 20th century, as you mentioned, in the 1980s, there was a rise of Islamic fundamentalism in Sudan. There was an attempt to impose Islamic law on the entire country, Sudan is an ethnically and religiously diverse country. Many different religions, many different ethnic groups, both Arab and African, Muslim, Christian, and traditional African religions are all practiced. And as part of the civil war that then broke out, the government, which is a dictatorship, revived this, system of slave raids that had largely been stamped out. And you have now the regime of General Omar al-Bashir, who took power in a coup in 1989. He's been the dictator leading Sudan since 1989. And at his direction, slave raids were revived, and tens of thousands of people were abducted into slavery. These were primarily women and children. So militiamen armed by the government were told when they destroyed a village that they could take booty, they could take reward. And their reward was, you know, livestock and grain and women and children. And they'd be roped by the neck, taken to the north, either sold off or kept by the different raiders, and forced to live as slaves. In the new collection of stories that I edited, Enslaved, there's the story of one young woman named Abuk Bak, who's 12 years old, and she's in her village, and suddenly the government militias swoop in. And she sees her grandfather shot in front of her, and one of the militiamen grabs her with a rope and takes her north. She's held in a pen, and then someone came to the slave pen and purchased her, and she was his slave for the next 10 years until she managed to run away.
Let's turn to you, Simon. You grew up in Tonga in southern Sudan. Tell us what your life was like before you were 9 years old.
I was born in a lovely family. I have a mom's and a dad, brothers and sisters. At the times when we learned how to talk, we were told that when you see an Arab soldiers come, you have to run, and you have to run for your lives. And it is exactly what has been going on at the time when I was growing up. The government troops will come constantly to come and burn down the villages.
And that was your whole life?
Yes, yes. Burn down the villages, and usually is people have to run and have to run for their lives. And those usually who cannot make it to runs, these are the people who will be they perish. The houses will be burned down, people will be burned alive. But unfortunately, until at the time when my father decided that to take his family to refuge, because these burning the villages, it is constantly. Constantly, the village will be burned down. So the villagers will come back from hidings and then rebuild the house, the huts again. And then the government troop will come for the second raids. And this has been going on systematically. And then my father took us into the capital of Malakand, which is the capital's city in Upper Niles, in which
That's still in the south, Simon?
Yes, in southern Sudan now.
Okay.
Where we live, we have an Arab family next as a neighbor to us. It was one of the of that family, an Arab family, who kidnapped me from Malakand and took me to the north.
Your neighbor kidnapped you?
Yeah.
Now, I want to understand something. First of all, you lived in the village where the Arabs came and pillaged you. That was your whole life.
Yeah.
Did you live in terror? Were you terrified all the time?
You see, the terror, to me, is just a very mild word to say. We are constantly on, you know, between death on every single moment. Because what happened when the troops will when they come to raid the villages, there are people who will die, there are people who will be killed. Those who couldn't run, those who have been captured, they will end up being slaughtered. The elders who cannot run, they will be burned alive.
Those are gruesome facts that you lived with. I'm trying to understand what it was like for a little boy to live with that every day, to see it, to fear it when he wasn't living with it.
You know, as a little boy, at that time, we probably, because we didn't know the outside worlds, we thought as a child, knowing that this is the life that we are in, we assumed that probably God made us to be in that way, that there is somebody who will come every day, Burn down your villages, the village, the house where you was born, the house where you have kept your property. Destroy every single thing that you owns, your family own, your grand family left to your family. They will destroy that. And then what we will do, what people will do after they did that, will come back and rebuild.
When you moved to the city, how old were you?
I was 8 years old.
Okay. Did you feel safer? Did your family tell you you were safer now?
No. My family was telling us that we are coming here. This is not our place. Probably we're going to be here for temporary, and then if things change, we will move back. Because they themselves, they don't see any solution to the problems. As I said before, nobody is talking about the solutions. So they themselves, they just praying that, you know, there may be a time where there is no this kind of atrocity, and then they will go back because their life is not made to be in the city. They're made to be in the village. These are people who was born in the village. These are people who never went to schools. So to be in the city itself is not a place where they can survive.
Tell us what happened to you when you were 9 years old.
When I was 9 years old, we have this gentleman by the name of Abdullah, which I mentioned before, as a neighbor to us. He was the one who asked me in the beginning to help him with his luggage. We live not far away from the River Niles. As a child, very innocent, just somebody asked to help. I give him help. He told me in the boat to sit next to his luggage, because according to him, that he's going to buy a thing in the market. And I said there, what happened was that he came back probably, but he didn't come where his luggage was, so I would have gone out. Until the board started leaving the station, in which I become terrified, crying. Immediately he came, and he told me not to cry, calm down. Now the board left the station. The only thing that I have to do, this is his statement, we have to go to the last destinations, in which I will put you back in the next boat that you will come back to the south. Being the only person that I know, I have to trust every single word he told me. When we arrived in Kosti, which is in northern Sudan now, it turned out that he had three other kids. Plus me, we are four now. He gave those two kids away in Kosti, and he took me with other kids in his suburb, his village in a suburb of Kosti, a village called Fashishoya. It was in Fashishoya in which he went and gave me to his relative as a gift. And I was still assuming that he will keep what he told me in the boat, that he will put me back. 3 days comes, and then I didn't see him. So I asked the family that I was given to, where is Abdullah? And then this is where the terror began.
What happened?
I was beaten. And I was told that I should not come and question them about Abdullah, or I should not even ask for Abdullah, because I'm not going to see him again, in which, according to them, I was given to them as a gift by him.
What happened to you when you heard that?
When I heard that, I could not even believe what they were telling me. And that's why I start crying. And then that's why they start beating me up to silence me. Because I cannot even believe what they're telling me, that I was now as a human being, and now I become as a gift to them. So what they did, and then they went on to bring the Sudanese currency with the picture of a human being with no legs to let me look at that picture, in which as a threat. They have went on to tell me that to look at that picture, if I'm thinking or trying to run away, they will capture me and they will cut my legs, and I will look exactly at what I'm seeing in the picture. As a child, being beaten now, you being threat, then I felt then their threat is real, and I become their slaves.
We're talking about modern-day slavery, specifically in the Sudan. You're listening to Simon Deng. When he was 9 years old, he was living in southern Sudan. He was kidnapped by a neighbor and taken into slavery. We're hearing his story. Soon we're going to hear the story of Samantha Gardner, who lives in Cherry Hill and got very involved in the modern-day slavery movement and the abolitionist movement when she first heard about it when she was 11 or 12 years old. Simon, let's come back to your story. What was your life like living with this family?
You know, the better word I can put it, that I was not living as a human being. I was living even worse than an animal can be, because for the simple reasons, I'm the first to get up in the morning as a child now, and I'm last to go to bed. In the mornings when kids in my age picking up their book going to schools, I have to pick up the packets going to the Nile to carry the water into the houses. And where we live at that time in Fishishoya, they don't have running water. The water being carried by the animals from the Nile into the houses. Now, since they have a slave in the house, that job become mine, plus the other domestic job.
How far was the Nile from
here? It was a quarter mile away. A quarter mile away, when you talk about it, and you're talking about a 9 years old now, being forced to do things which is physically is not a job a child can do. That itself is a living hell.
What else did you have to do?
I have to do all the domestic job in the house, in which that wash the dishes, clean the anything, and most important, I am there as a piece of property in which I don't know how to say no to anything. In other words, all I know at that time is yes and yes to everything, even the thing that any human being should say no to it.
When we spoke to you before the show, you used that language. You said you did not know how to say yes. What do you mean?
What I mean by that time, because usually as a child now, somebody in that family will decide it to say, I call you and you didn't say yes so loudly. What do you have in mind? Then I will be punished for that. And it become a routine that all I know is yes. Even somebody just turned his head to me, I have to say yes to that person, assuming that he did call me. And then I don't want to be punished, so I have to yes it so loudly so that to avoid punishment. In other words, I was living under the terror constantly.
Did you wonder where your family was, where your parents were?
I know for sure that my family is in the South, and I know for sure that I come from the South, and I know for sure that I'm now being held as a piece of property by those family. But how to get back to my family, that is the thing that was beyond me.
Tell us about the family who owned you. What kind of people were they?
I was owned by an Arab family. All of them are Muslims. And in fact, everybody in that place in Fishishoya is happened to be an Arab and in Muslims. And then at the same times, when I talk about doing a domestic job, it's not just to that family that owned me, even to extended family that somebody will call, come and do things. Why? Because I'm an abid which is abid to all of them, which is a slave to all of them.
You were a slave to them. You were a piece of property to them. What were they to you?
To me, at that time as a child, I look at them as maybe they are a god to me.
Power, that powerful.
Yes.
I read a quote from a woman in East Africa. She said, God created me to be a slave, like a camel was created to be a camel. That quote's kind of breathtaking. Did you ever feel like that when you were in slavery?
You know, to be in that kind of situation in which that you don't have any outside beside where you are, of course you assume to be like that. And I agree. I agree exactly with that quotation, because in my case, that I don't know where the East and where the West. All I know is the family, and I have to serve them, and I have to serve them in any capacity that they wanted me to do.
What's your religion?
I'm a Christian.
So you believed in God back then?
As a child, and you're talking about somebody who is 9 years old, all these things was not there. But I assume that I'm created as a human being. But now I'm being owned by somebody. Why? I didn't have answer for that at that time.
I met you. You were in Cherry Hill last year.
Yes.
Lecturing at synagogues and high schools. But I didn't meet you then. I met you at Samantha Gardner's bat mitzvah. It was about a month ago, wasn't it, Sam?
Yes, it was.
So let's switch gears here, and I want to know how you got involved. How did you first become aware of the issue of slavery?
Well, when I was in Hebrew school in fifth grade, I read a reference to in a magazine called Baba Ghanoush instead of Baba Ghanoush, and it was called. There was an article called "American Idol No More," except "Idol" was spelled IDLE. In like they were saying, these kids are moving now; they're not like standing still anymore. And it was all about kids who were getting up and taking action. And I saw a reference to a girl who was making jewelry to help free the slaves in Sudan.
Back up just a little bit. No, not back up from the mic. I mean, your story back up a little bit. What happened? How did you first hear about slavery?
In that article, it just said that reference. And it said she read an earlier article. And I was just stunned. I had no idea that slavery was still alive. I, like the millions of people in America, thought that it was, like, that it ended in the 1800s with the Civil War.
The risk of being annoying here, when you said you were stunned, I want to hear more. I want to hear more about your reaction the first minute you heard about these atrocities. Do you remember?
Yeah. I was so taken aback. Like, I just kept staring at those words, to free the slaves in Sudan. I couldn't get my eyes off those words. I wasn't really reading them. I was just staring at them. I was staring into space. A thousand thoughts rushing through my head. All because I had no idea. Like, you would think. I thought that I watched the news every morning, and I thought I knew what was going on in the world. But something this big, you'd think that people would have heard about. And it was just an eye-opening moment for me.
What were your next steps? I know a lot of girls and boys your age would have heard about it and said, that's horrible, and let's move on to the next chapter, the next topic. The majority would.
I went home, and I still couldn't stop thinking about it, and I went to the Baba Ghanoush website, and I checked on the article in which she was referring to, and it was all about Francis Bach's life, and he was a slave in Sudan as well, and there was a small reference in there to I Abolish, to the American Anti-Slavery Group, which Jesse Sage works for, and I searched that, the American Anti-Slavery Group, and the first website was I Abolish, and I spent hours that night researching it and finding out all I could find online, and at the time it seemed like a lot of information to absorb, but I think I thought there would have been a lot more. Like,
I have a question that you might not have an answer to, and that's why. Why were you so upset? Why did you work so hard? What did all this mean to you that you were so outraged?
I think because every Passover, we hear about how there were slaves and how we were slaves in Egypt. And that really, honestly, doesn't mean that much to me. It might mean a lot to somebody else, but I always get the feeling like, oh, this was sad, but it was so many years ago. And to hear, there was a reference in the article that said, less than 1,000 miles, like, away from where the Jews were slaves in Egypt thousands of years ago. That's where people were being slaves.
Simon, what's happening with you right now as you're listening to this story?
You know, it is something as a victim's, I cannot believe it when you have a young lady at that age taking responsibility on behalf of the people that he never knows, he never met. That is itself to me as an emotion thing, because in where I come from, and even up to today, and I was in Sudan 2 months ago, to see young kids that we brought back from the slavery, and then to come back to the United States and see people like Tamantha now being outraged on behalf of those kids. And to be honest with you, those kids over there, they don't know that there is somebody like Tamantha working on their behalf. I personally, I didn't know. Even when I got out from the slavery, I thought I'm going to put this thing behind me and then go on with my life like any other human being. And indeed, I did that until I come to New York, in which I read in the newspaper that was in 1993-94 that you can buy a human being in Sudan for $10. And that reporter who wrote that article got those information from the United Nations itself, in which that we assume that the UN will be the right persons to say that these atrocities should not be tolerated at these times.
Simon, when Samantha was telling her story, you were moved to tears. And I was wondering who you were crying for. Was it for you? Was it for the children that are still there? Who were the tears for?
You know, to be honest with you, what happened to me is not irrelevant. It's gone. But what about those whom I still being held as a slave today? Those who have no hope of being free. Now, as an American citizen, in which I would have just gone my way and do my own things like any other human beings, and I should not even come and remind myself of what happened to me. But still, how can I be live in denial, knowing that what it means to be a slave, knowing every pain that what I went through as a child, there is another child going through today, and that's exactly what happened.
Sam?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, for the question you asked me about why, I thought of a better answer. Like, I was thinking about it afterwards, and I think the real reason is that as a Jew, I feel really connected to it because 6 million people died in the Holocaust, and those 6 million people could have done so much. They would have been alive today and had children and grandchildren. So many more people would have been in this world, and some of those people, one of them could have found the cure to cancer. One of them could have found the cure to the common cold. Authors, dentists, everything, all the professions, those people, and they're lost to this world. And I just don't think that should ever happen to anyone ever again.
So the phrase, never forget, you take to heart.
I do. And I also think that a lot of people say that, but then they let this genocide go on.
Right. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to come back to you, Simon, and talk about how you got out and what's happened since then. And then I want to talk to all three of you about what you're doing and what we all need to be doing to end this or to begin to end this. We're talking about modern-day slavery, specifically the atrocities that are happening in the Sudan. We're talking with Simon Deng, who grew up in southern Sudan. He's now an American citizen, but he was taken into slavery when he was 9 years old. We're with Samantha Gardner, who's now 13, a couple of years ago when she first heard about modern-day slavery in Hebrew school in Cherry Hill. She became outraged and got very involved and met Simon. We're also joined on the phone by Jesse Sage. He's a member of the board of directors of the American Anti-Slavery Group, and they can be found on the webpage iabolish.org. That's one word, iabolish.org. He's co-authored Enslaved, True Stories of Modern-Day Slavery. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Have you been treated for bipolar disorder or experienced a manic or mixed episode within the last 3 months? If so, you may be eligible to participate in Penn's clinical study of an investigational medication for bipolar disorder. To learn more, 215-573-8582. Eligible participants may receive study-related medication, lab work, and evaluations. 215-573-8582.
When a Los Angeles rabbi died, his widow began sorting through some of his old taped services.
One in particular stood out.
Our destinies are tied together.
It featured a 1965 temple appearance by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I didn't realize how historical it would turn out to be.
An MLK moment uncovered.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about modern-day slavery and specifically the atrocities that are taking place in the Sudan. My guest on the telephone is Jesse Sage, board member, a member of the board of directors of the American Anti-Slavery Group, and their webpage is iabolish.org. I'm also joined by Simon Deng, who grew up in the southern Sudan and was taken into slavery when he was 9 years old. He's now an American citizen, and we're going to hear more about what he is doing in this country. And we're also joined here in the studio by Samantha Gardner. She is a seventh grader in Cherry Hill who's been actively involved fighting modern-day slavery, specifically in the Darfur movement. So, Simon, let's come back and talk to you about how you got out of slavery.
When I got out, it was not because I managed to get out by myself. That family have to move to a big city because their son have to go to the junior high schools. And where we were, they didn't have a junior high school, so they have to move to the big city, which is by the name Costi. It was in Costi where I saw three gentlemen, and they have the Shuluk mark in their forehead like what I have today. And I know those marks is belong to one tribe, and that tribe is the Shuluk where I belong to. So when I saw them for the first time, I couldn't believe my eyes, and then I walked to them, and I have to introduce myself and tell them that my name, my father name, my mom names, tell them anything to believe me because I didn't have the Shuluk mark in my forehead.
How did you get the freedom to approach them?
Because when I saw the them with the Shuluk mark in their forehead, I couldn't believe my eyes after 3.5 years. So this is what the first time to see somebody carrying the symbols of my tribes. So I talked to them and I told them what condition that I am in. Since they didn't know me, one of them said that, you know, we have somebody who come from the village that you mentioned, in which we will go and talk to that person, and he will come and see you. He will be the one who will know whether you come from that village. When they told me that, I got disappointed, in which I, you know, I felt like got disappointed in what I'm hearing from them. And one of them told me that the only thing that because they don't know me, but they know the person from the village that I mentioned to them. So indeed they went and then came back the following day with the same persons. When I saw that person turn out that it is somebody that I know from my village, and I was so happy when I saw him, but he broke down in tears because everybody assumed in my family I'm not longer alive.
Right.
And that's why he started crying, because everybody assumed that I'm already dead, because my father did put an offer 10 cows to anybody who will come up with the information where his son was.
And what's 10 cows worth?
Oh, 10 cows mean a lot. 10 cows mean a lot.
So I want to understand two things you said that confused me. These men from your tribe, they didn't know if in fact you were from their tribe, but here's this young boy, a black boy, who's obviously in slavery. They didn't question that, did they?
No, they didn't question being me in slavery. What they didn't know, because I don't have the Shuluk tribal marks in my head. At the same time, they probably they're from the northern Shuluks, and I'm from this far away from the southern Shuluk. So indeed, they didn't know me. And all they wanted to verify it is to bring somebody who happened to come from the village I mentioned to them.
So, shortly thereafter, you got back, you were reunited with your family.
Yeah, that individual, he was the one who took me out from the slaver and took me back to the southern Sudan, in which I was reunited with my family.
When you were back with your family, did you again live in fear of these raids? They hadn't stopped.
When I was back into my family, the first things I have to do is to put the tribal marks in my forehead, for the simple reasons. And the reason is, when I was in slavery, that family was urging me that I have to take an offer, which is I will be converted to Islam, given an Arab name, and become their sons. And that itself was terrifying me at that moment. So what I did in the first place is to put the Shuluk tribal marks in my face.
And these are these raised
yes.
indentations. They
yes.
look like scars
yes.
on your forehead.
Yes. So that if somebody will kidnap me, because in the back of my head, I was afraid of any person happened to be an Arab.
I want to jump ahead now to where you are now. We're going to have to skip ahead many years. They took away your humanity, your sense of humanity. When did you get that back?
You see, indeed they took away everything, even to the point that whenever that I'm close, and all I have to do always is to do my best to put everything behind me. And sometimes it is not easy. There are moments where you forgot, you assume like you forgot, but there are moments where they will come back and it will hit you like a rock.
Even today?
Yes.
Yeah. You have post-traumatic stress disorder, of course. You're living in this country? You're living in New York?
Yes, I live in New York, yes.
And you're married?
Yes.
You're working as a...
I work with the City of New York as a lifeguard.
And you were a swimming champion?
Yes.
In the Sudan?
In Sudan, yeah.
Do you feel safe, by and large, or do you still look over your shoulder?
You see, it is not the question of safety, because what happened in Sudan, and you look around, you will see somebody who is going through what I went through. In Sudan, you will not go even a mile not to find a child in the same situation in which I was. And that itself, it is not just a matter of fear, but it is a matter of why, and why the thing have to be in that way.
Okay, so let's talk now about what needs to be done. Sam, when you first heard about what was going on, you went and raised money. You did whatever you could, and I'm told you raised $600 in sixth
yes,
grade.
Yes, I started selling jewelry. I got the idea from that girl in the magazine, and at first it was like simple jewelry, and then I started using wire and beads, and I also had a bake sale with all the girls in my class outside of Super J.
What does money do?
Well, $36 can free a slave in Sudan, and I was raising money to try to free as many slaves as I could.
So, in effect, you can buy a human being out of slavery for $36?
Yes, and it also provides them with, like, a survival kit with like a mini stove, blankets.
Tell me about the mechanics of that.
See, let me just jump into what Samantha was saying with $36. You have to look at the articles which was in the New York City Suns at that time, and that articles was the report which the reporter got from the United Nations reports. And the United Nations was sent by the UN to go and investigate the issue of slavery, and that it is the same person we sent by the World Body came up with that report that you can buy a human being in Sudan for $10. So when she talk about $60, you know, you're talking about six human beings can be free by that. And that itself, you know, makes we as in a free world, assuming that, yes, slavery is evil things, and everybody assume that slavery is all over, and slavery become the history of the past. At the same time, you can buy a human being today in Sudan.
Let me come back with and talk to you, Jesse Sage. Tell us what the American anti-slavery group is doing and needs to do.
Well, first thing I should say, one of the things that we do is we give an opportunity for the incredible people that you have on your show today to empower them to do the advocacy and awareness work that they do. First of all, Samantha is one of thousands of Americans who are doing advocacy work to help stop slavery not only in Sudan but around the world. And Simon is a member of our Speakers Bureau, and there are several other survivors of slavery that we've given a platform to that go around speaking all over the country, telling their story and calling Americans to act. These are the modern-day Frederick Douglasses of the 21st century abolitionist movement.
Jesse,
and certainly, if any of your listeners are interested in bringing someone like Simon to speak at their community, at their school, at their congregation, to their civic group, our organization helps facilitate that. But on a higher level, our strategy is fourfold. The first is to raise awareness, simply because, as Samantha said, many, if not a majority of Americans think that slavery ended in 1865, and we have to, the first step is to open minds and open eyes. The second thing that we do is advocacy. We've testified to Congress. We've helped advance legislation that fights slavery in different forms around the world. The third thing we do is do activism. So we have 30,000 activists on our online action network who send petitions, who send emails, who send faxes. People who want to join and get involved can register at iabolish.org or iabolish.com. And the fourth thing that we do is we provide direct aid on the ground. In different cases and in different examples around the world, we're trying to leverage the small funds that we have to make an impact, to help not only free people from slavery, but help rehabilitate people who have been already rescued from slavery. And that is the strategy that we're pursuing. And we've certainly come a long way, because 10 years ago, no one was paying attention to this issue. And now, while there's still a long way to go, it's amazing how much has changed, even just in the last few years. And that's because of people like Simon speaking out, because of survivors like Simon, and because of amazing young activists like Samantha.
Slavery today, I read, is worse than it ever was. Is that true?
Well, numerically speaking, there are more people enslaved today around the world than ever before. So there are more people in the world than ever before, but there are also more slaves than ever before. It's hard for me to make a comparison between other times in history, which I did not live through. Any slavery is bad. The advantage that we have today is two things over past abolitionist movements. As bad as the situation is today, the first thing is that we've won the moral argument against slavery. So we don't have to win a moral battle as well as leading a strategic struggle against slavery. And the second thing is that we have modern technology that can connect people. And so we have thousands of people all over the country and even around the world who are part of our online action network. And it also means that actions that people like Samantha take here in the U.S. can have an impact halfway around the world in Sudan. And I think that technology and communication is a tool that can actually help abolitionists and mobilize abolitionists in a way that was never possible before.
Samantha, what are your plans in the short run around this issue?
Well, I am going, I'm trying to put together an event that would have a couple speakers, that would raise awareness and partially raise money for Darfur and to speak out against slavery. And we're in the process of working on this, like how we're going to put that together.
Simon, in the couple of minutes we have left, let's say everyone listening to the show now is as upset as I am right now. What would you like our listeners to do?
First of all, let me just get back to the question when we talk about if slavery is worse than before. Yes, it is true. It is worse than ever before because we're living in a time in which all of us now agree that slavery is the evils. We live in a time where we assume that nobody should own another fellow human being as a piece of property. At the same time, there are people who are still owning other people. What will we do? Yes, we have to be outraged and say that because seeing all of us agree that we are all human beings as brothers and sisters, how can we be silent when other fellow human beings are still being enslaved?
What would you like us to do tomorrow, those listening to the show?
Get involved and be the voice, especially be the voice for those who have no voice.
Well, from the bottom of my heart, Simon, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for what you've done, what you're doing, and what you're teaching. Sam, same to you. You're an amazing human being, and I have great gratitude for the work you're doing and the way you're educating all of us.
I'm glad I could be here today.
Kind of role model you are. Jesse Sage, thank you also for taking the time to join us and for the work you're doing.
Thank you for spotlighting this issue.
And we need more than we need more Samantha out there.
Simon Deng is a human rights activist, and he's fighting to end modern day slavery. As is Samantha Gardner. She is 13 years old and living in Cherry Hill in seventh grade. Sage is a member of the board of directors of the American Anti-Slavery Group, and you can find them at iabolish.org. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Bow. 1,300 of God's children here suffering. Sometimes going hungry.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Michael Honey about the campaign Martin Luther King was working on when he was assassinated, a general strike in support of Memphis sanitation workers. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Listen for today's Voices in the Family again on Sunday morning at 6 o'clock. Hello, I'm Robin Bloom. Today is